I'd talk to her. Ask her. I got the feeling... Again, Mary stops herself. Talk to her. I can't face work. I text Clarissa. Still researching. Back later. And head straight home. By the time I reach Wandsworth, I've left Mummy 3 voicemails, texted, and sent her an email, entitled, We Need to Talk. But I haven't had a response. I'll go round there in person if I have to. Right now, though, I need some quiet time to digest what I've just heard. An ongoing nightmare. How long has Dan been dealing with an ongoing nightmare? It's something to do with my mother, Mary said. Is this the £1 million, maybe 2? Oh, God, what's going on? What? And worse. What if Mary's wrong? What if I'm the ongoing nightmare? The thought makes me feel cold and rather small inside. I'm remembering Dan's face last night, the way he said, I can't do this. As though he was at the end of his tether. Every time I remember last night, I cringe inside. I called him a boring fucking cliché. I assumed he was just following the same old tedious trope. Husband hooks up with old flame, lies to wife. But there's more. There's something else. As I'm walking, I pull out my phone, wanting to text him again, wanting to make it right. I even get as far as, Dear Dan. But then I stop. What do I say? Phrases shoot into my mind, but I instantly discard them one by one. Tell me who the other Mary is. Please don't shut me out anymore. I know you have an ongoing nightmare. What is it? If he wanted to tell me, he would have told me. Which brings me back to the question that fills me with foreboding. Am I his ongoing nightmare? As I walk along our street, tears are running down my face. But when I see Toby, I hastily scrub them away. He's standing outside Tilda's house, clutching her pair of rollerblades and a helmet. Hi, Toby, I say. I knew you'd be back. Getting my blades, he nods. I forgot to take them. He dumps them in the boot of an open Corsa, which I don't recognize. Is that your car? I say curiously as he locks it. Meechie's. Actually, I'd better tell her I took it. He perches on the garden wall, sending a text. The sun has come out, and when he's finished texting, he leans back, savoring the warmth, seeming utterly unhurried. Don't you have a job? I'll go in later. It's fine, he shrugs. We normally work like noon to midnight. Midnight? I suddenly feel very ancient. Right. Well, make sure you see your mum while you're here. Is she around? Yeah. She's making me spaghetti bolognese. His face lights up and I can't help smiling. He must have made Tilda's day coming home so soon. Either that, or they're yelling at each other again. Do you want to come for lunch? He adds politely. I'm sure we've got some spare. No, thanks, I try to smile. I've got some stuff to... It's all a bit... Without intending to, I sigh heavily and sit down next to him on the wall. Do you ever feel like there's a conspiracy? I'm not really expecting an answer, but Toby nods gravely. There is a conspiracy. I've told you, Sylvie. It's all a conspiracy. The sun's getting hotter on our faces. He must be sweltering with his beard. I get out my sunglasses and reach for my lip balm, and as I unbutton the pink case, Toby nods at it, as though that proves everything. Big pharma, Sylvie. You see? I don't respond. I'm gazing at the gold-embossed P.S. I can't believe Dan used my private nickname in texts to another woman. I can't believe he referred to me as the P.S. Factor. The Princess Sylvie Factor. Just the idea of some other woman calling me that makes me cringe. It's almost the worst betrayal. Who is she? Who is she? What would you do if you'd found a whole load of texts on a phone and you didn't know who they were to? I say, staring up at the blue sky. Get the number off contacts, says Toby with a shrug. A number doesn't tell you anything, I object. Google it then. See if anything comes up. I turn to stare at him. Google it. I never even thought of Googling it. Mobile phone numbers aren't on Google, I say, warily. Sometimes they are. Worth a try. Whose phone? He asks with interest, and my defences instantly rise. Oh, just a girl at work, I say. Her cousin, I add for good measure. Half-cousin. It's not a big deal. I could Google the number. Suddenly I'm all jittery. I need to get to a computer. Now. Well, see you, Tobes, I say, getting to my feet. Bring Michi over. We'd like to meet her. Sure. Bye, Sylvie. I hurry into the house, fumbling with my key in my haste. It seems to take forever for my computer to fire up, and I actually start saying, come on, come on, under my breath. I type in the phone number from the text and wait breathlessly for the results, although if I was hoping for an instant answer, I was an idiot. There's a lot of garbage to wade through. Entries about car serial numbers and phone directory pages without any actual information. But on page 5, I see something that makes me lean forward. St. Saviour's School Rugby Club. Parent rep, Mary Smith Sullivan. It's her. The same mobile number, the same first name. Oh, God, she exists. Can I find out anything else about her? Does she have a job, maybe? My heart beating wildly, I look up Mary Smith Sullivan on LinkedIn. And there she is. Mary Smith Sullivan, partner Avery Milton. Specialism. Defamation, privacy, and other media-related litigation. She looks to be in her early 50s, with close-cropped dark hair and a boxy jacket. Minimal makeup. She's smiling, but not in a warm way, more in a business-like, I have to smile for this photo way. This is who Dan is sending endless texts to. He can't be having an affair with her. He can't. I mean, he can't. I stare at the page, trying and failing to make sense of it. Then at last, with a trembling hand, I reach for my phone and dial. Avery Milton, how can I help you? A sing-song voice greets me. I'd like to make an appointment with Ms. Smith Sullivan, I say in a rush, today. As soon as possible, please. Avery Milton is a medium-sized law firm off Chancery Lane, with a reception area on the 14th floor. It has a big floor-to-ceiling window, showing off an impressive view over London, which made my legs nearly give way when I stepped out of the lift. People should not just put terrifying windows there like that. But somehow I made it to the front desk and got my visitor's pass, and now I'm in the seating area, firmly turned away from the view. As I sit there, pretending to read a magazine, I look around carefully. I study the slate-grey sofas and the people in suits striding through and even the water dispenser. But there aren't any clues. I have no idea what this place has to do with Dan. I am also unimpressed by their timekeeping. I've been sitting here for at least half an hour. Mrs. Tilda? My chest seizes up in apprehension as I see a woman approaching me. It's her. She has the same close-cropped hair that she did on LinkedIn. She's wearing a navy jacket and a blue striped shirt I recognize from Zara. Expensive shoes. A wedding ring. I'm Mary Smith Sullivan, she smiles professionally and holds out a manicured hand. Apologies for keeping you. How do you do? Oh, hi, my voice catches, and I can only produce a squawk. Hi, I try again, scrambling to my feet. Yes, thank you. How do you do? My pseudonym is Mrs. Tilda, which is not ideal, but I was so flustered as I made the appointment that I wasn't thinking straight. When the receptionist asked, and the name? I panicked and blurted out, Tilda. Then I quickly amended, Mrs. Tilda. Mrs. Penelope Tilda. Penelope Tilda. What was I thinking? No one's called Penelope Tilda. But I haven't been challenged yet. Although, as we walk along a neutral, pale-carpeted corridor, Mary Smith Sullivan shoots me the odd appraising look. I didn't say why I wanted the appointment on the phone. I just kept saying it was highly confidential and highly urgent, until the receptionist said, Of course, Mrs. Tilda. I booked you in for 2:30 p.m. Mary Smith Sullivan ushers me into a fairly large office, with, thankfully, quite a small window, and I sit down on a blue upholstered chair. There's a still unbearable pause as she pours us each a glass of water. So, at last she faces me properly and gives one of those professional smiles again. Mrs. Tilda, how can I help you? This is exactly what I predicted she'd say, and I have my line all ready to fling at her, just like a soap opera heroine. I want to know why my husband's been texting you, bitch. Okay, not bitch. Not in real life. Mrs. Tilda, she prompts pleasantly. I want to know... I break off and swallow. Shit. I promised myself I was going to be calm and steely, but my voice is already wobbling. Okay, take a moment. No rush. Actually, there is a rush. This woman probably costs £1,000 an hour, and she'll bill me, even if she is Dan's mistress. Especially then. And I haven't even thought about how I'll afford it. Shit. Why didn't I find out the fee? Quick, Sylvie. Talk. I take a deep breath, gathering my thoughts, and glance out of the window of her door. And what I see makes me nearly pass out. It's Mummy. She's wearing a pink suit and walking quickly toward this room with a hugely fat guy in pinstripes, talking animatedly while he cocks his head to listen. What the fuck is my mother doing here? Already, my legs are propelling me to the door of Mary Smith Sullivan's office. I'm grabbing the handle like a demented person. Mummy! I demand, my voice strident. Mummy! Both Mummy and the fat, pinstriped guy stop dead, and Mummy's face freezes in a rictus of dismay. So it is you, she says. It is me. I look from her to the fat, pinstriped guy. What does that mean? It is me. Of course it's me. Mummy, why are you here? I'm the one who called your mother, Sylvie, says Mary Smith Sullivan behind me, and I swivel round to face her. You know me. I thought it was you as soon as I saw you in reception. I've seen photos and your hair's quite distinctive, although of course the false name, she shrugs. But still, I was sure it was you. Darling, why are you here? Demands Mummy, almost accusingly. What brought you here? Because, I stare at her bewildered, then turn back to Mary Smith Sullivan. I want to know why my husband's been texting you. Finally, I've managed to get my line out, but it's lost its sting. Everything has lost its meaning. I feel as though I've walked into a stage play, and I don't know my part. Yes, I expect you do, says Mary, and she regards me with a kind of pity, the same kind of pity Dan had. I always said you should know, but... Mrs. Winter, the fat pinstriped guy speaks in a booming voice as he approaches me. I do apologize. Let me introduce myself. I'm Roderick Rice, and I've been dealing with this issue, along with Mary, of course. What issue? I feel as though I might scream or kill someone. What bloody issue? I look from Mary Smith Sullivan to Roderick to Mummy, who is hovering outside the office door with one of her evasive mummy looks. What is it? What? I can see eyes meeting, silent consultations flying around. Is anyone in touch with Dan? Mary says to Roderick at length. He's gone to Devon. To see what he can do down there. I tried him earlier, but... Roderick shrugs. No signal, probably. Devon? Why is Dan gone to Devon? But Mary nods as though this makes total sense. Just thinking of the P.S. factor, she says quietly. The P.S. factor? Again? I can't bear it. Please, don't call me that. My voice explodes out of me like a rocket. I'm not a princess. I'm not Princess Sylvie. I wish Dan had never given me that stupid nickname. Both lawyers turn to survey me in what seems like genuine surprise. P.S. doesn't stand for Princess Sylvie, says Mary Smith Sullivan at last. Not in this office. But, I stare at her, taken aback. Then what? There's silence. And once again she gives me that odd, pitying look, as though she knows far more about me than I do. Protect Sylvie, she says. It stands for Protect Sylvie. For an instant I can't speak. My mouth won't work. Protect me? From what? I manage at last and turn to Mummy, who's still standing at the doorway. Mummy? Oh, darling, she starts blinking furiously. It's been so difficult to know what to do. Your husband loves you very much, says Mary Smith Sullivan. And I think he's been acting for all the right reasons, but she breaks off and looks at Roderick, then at Mummy. This is ridiculous. She's got to know. We sit in Mary's little seating area with cups of tea in proper cups and saucers, brought in by an assistant. I cradle mine in my hands, not drinking it, just gripping it tightly. It's something tangible. It's something real, where nothing else in my life seems to be. Let me give you the bare facts, says Mary in her measured way, when at last the assistant leaves. It has been alleged that your father had an affair many years ago with a 16-year-old girl. I look back at her, silently. I don't know what I was expecting. Not this. Daddy, a 16-year-old girl. I glance at Mummy, who is staring at a distant corner of the room. Is it true? I manage. Of course it's not true, snaps Mummy. The whole thing is falsehood. Wretched, evil falsehood. She starts to blink furiously again. When I think of your father, the girl in question, who is now an adult, continues Mary impassively, threatened to expose this affair in a book. This was prevented. What book? I say, confused. A book about my father? Not exactly, no. Have you heard of a writer called Joss Burton? Through the High Maze? I stare at her. I've read it. She had a really hard time before her success. She had an eating disorder. She had to drop out of university. I swallow, feeling ill. Did Daddy? No. It's all lies, says Mummy, tearfully. It was all in her head. She became fixated by your father because he was so handsome. An early draft contained an account of her alleged affair with your father and its effect upon her, Mary resumes. Obviously, at 16, she wasn't underage. Nevertheless, it's... She hesitates. Not particularly easy reading. Not particularly easy reading. My mind registers this phrase and then veers away from it. There's only so much I can deal with at one time. Your father became aware of the book and engaged our firm. We applied for an injunction on his behalf, although in the event the author was persuaded to excise the relevant passages. Persuaded? Dan was very helpful, says Mummy, wiping her nose. Dan, I look from face to face. Your father wished to keep the matter within the family, so he enlisted Dan's help. There's something about Mary's tone that makes me look sharply at her. I would say that Dan worked above and beyond for your father, she says. He became our contact. He read every document. He attended every meeting with Joss Burton and her lawyers and managed to turn what were fairly difficult discussions into something more constructive. As your mother says, it was his personal intervention which, in the end, persuaded Joss Burton to attract the relevant passages. Dan was pleased to help, says Mummy, defensively. Only too pleased to help. My head is spinning like a kaleidoscope. Daddy, Dan, Joss Burton. That book lying in Mummy's kitchen. Dan's tension. All the whispers, all the huddling. I knew there was something. I knew it. Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't anyone tell me? My voice bursts forth in a roar. Why am I the only person sitting here who doesn't know any of this? Darling, says Mummy, hastily. Daddy was appalled by this vicious slander. He didn't want you hearing salacious, invented stories. We decided to keep the whole matter under wraps. And then, just as things were settled, your father died, puts in Roderick in a ponderous, heavy way, and everything changed again. You were so Fragile, Sylvie. Mummy reaches out a hand and squeezes mine. You were so devastated. We couldn't tell you, any of us. Besides which, we thought the whole thing was over. She starts blinking again. And isn't it? No, I answer myself, thinking aloud. Of course it's not. Otherwise, why are you here? I stare around at the faces again, thoughts springing up in my brain so fast I can barely get them out. Why is Dan in Devon? What's the 1 million maybe two? I round on Mummy. Is that to do with this? What's been happening? Oh, sweetheart, says Mummy vaguely, her eyes swiveling away, and I quell a sharp response. She's so frustrating. Joss Burton has written another memoir, says Mary. A prequel, describing her earlier life. She is adamant that this time she will describe her alleged relationship with your father. Apparently it is key to her story. It's due to be published in a year's time, when the film of Through the High Maze comes out. A film, says Mummy in distaste. Who wants to watch a film about her? I bite back the retort. Who wants to watch a story about a woman who overcame her demons to become a massive global businesswoman? Oh, no one, I should think. The new book will be very high profile, continues Mary. Serialized in a national newspaper, no doubt, and your father's name with it. Her advance is a million, puts in Roderick. Although, of course, she says it's not about the money, it's about the truth. The truth, says Mummy, a vicious edge to her voice. If this book is published, if your father is remembered for that, after all his charity work, her voice rises shrilly. It's wicked. And anyway, how could she remember after all these years? So, why is Dan in Devon? I'm looking from face to face. I still don't understand. He's talking to Joss Burton again, says Mummy, dabbing at her nose with a tiny lace handkerchief. She lives in Devon. He went down on the sleeper train. Last night. Mary gives me a kind look. I think one of the biggest strains for Dan in all of this has been keeping the truth from you. The sleeper train. I thought he was with his lover, when all the time, my throat is suddenly clogged as I picture Dan getting on a train all alone, shouldering this all alone. I stare into my tea, my eyes getting hot, trying to stay composed. He never breathed a word, I say at last. Not a word. His biggest concern all along has been that you might find out and not cope, as he put it, says Mary. Have another episode, puts in Roderick, tactfully. It wasn't an episode, my voice rockets out, and I see Roderick exchanging startled looks with Mummy. It wasn't an episode or a breakdown or whatever everyone said, I say more calmly. It was grief. Just that. Yes, I was devastated. But just because I found Daddy's death hard to process, it doesn't mean I was unstable. Dan worried about me too much. He was overprotective, far too overprotective. We were all worried, darling, says Mummy defensively. You were worried I might embarrass you, I snap, and turn to Mary, who I sense is the most receptive to what I'm saying. Dan had the best possible motives, and I don't blame him, but he got it wrong. I could have coped, and he should have told me. You all should have told me. I put my cup down on the coffee table with a bang. So now I want to know everything. I meet Mary's eyes, and I can see her taking the measure of me. At last, she nods. Very well. I'll give you access to all the files. You'll have to look at them here in the office, but I can give you a room to sit in. Thank you, I match her businesslike tone. Sylvie, darling, Mummy makes an anguished face. I really wouldn't. You really don't need to know. I do, I cut her off furiously. I've been living in a bubble. Well, now I'm stepping out of it. I don't need protecting. I don't need shielding. Protect Sylvie is over. I shoot a savage look around the room. Over. I sit alone, reading and reading, My eyes blur over. My head starts to hurt. An assistant brings me 3 more cups of tea, but they all sit going cold, undrunk, because I'm too wrapped up in what I'm seeing, what I'm understanding. My head is a whirl. How can all this have been happening? And I had no idea. What kind of blind, oblivious moron have I been? Joss Burton used to go on holiday to Los Bosques Antiguos. That's where she apparently met Daddy. None of this is in doubt. Her family genuinely did have a house there, very close to ours. Her parents did socialize with Mummy and Daddy. I don't remember them, but then again, I was only 3 or 4 at the time. Then there's all the stuff she alleges. Stuff about Daddy giving her presents, plying her with cocktails, leading her into the woods. And I couldn't bring myself to read that properly. Just the idea of it made me feel ill. I skimmed only a few pages, taking in phrases here and there, and felt even more sickened. My father, with a naive, inexperienced teenage girl, who'd never even... Mary Smith Sullivan was right. It's not particularly easy reading. So I hastened on to the emails, the present-day correspondence, the actual case. There are hundreds of emails in the files, thousands even. Daddy to Dan, Dan back to Daddy, Roderick to both of them, Dan to Mary, Mary back to Dan. And the more I read, the more shocked I am. Daddy's emails are so abrupt, demanding, entitled. Dan is resolutely polite, resolutely charming. But Daddy, Daddy pushes him around. He expects Dan to drop everything. He swears at him when things go wrong. He's a bully. I can't believe I'm having these thoughts about my father, my charming, twinkly father. A bully? I mean, yes, he sometimes lost it with his staff, but never with his family. Surely. I keep reading, hoping desperately to discover the email where he's appreciative, where he thanks Dan for all his efforts, where he gushes. He was a charming person. Where's the charm here? After 258 emails, I haven't yet found it, and my stomach is heavy. Everything makes horrible sense. This is why Dan's relationship with Daddy deteriorated, because Daddy dragged him into his problems and made them his, and treated him like mud. No wonder Dan talked about an ongoing nightmare. Daddy was the nightmare. At last I raise my head, my cheeks flaming. I'm churned up. I want to wade in. I want to confront Daddy. I want to have it out. Phrases are flying around my head. How could you? Apologize. You can't speak to Dan like that. That's my husband. But Daddy's dead. He's dead. It's too late. I can't confront him. I can't talk to him. I can't demand to know why he behaved like that. Or have it out. Or make it right. It's all too late. Far too late. And guilt is rising in me, making my face still warmer. Because I didn't help Dan, did I? All along I blanked out Daddy's flaws. I glorified him. I made it impossible for Dan ever to speak the truth. And that was the chasm. Are you okay? I jump, shocked at Mary's voice, and abruptly realize I'm rocking back and forth in my chair, my jaw jutting out as though for a fight. Fine, I hastily sit upright. Fine, it's quite heavy stuff. Yes. She gives me a sympathetic look. Probably a bit much to try to digest it all. I need to go anyway. I glance at my watch. School pickup time. Ah, she nods. Well, come back any time you'd like. Ask me anything you'd like to know. Have you heard from Dan? The question spills out before I can stop it. No, she gives me a neutral look. I'm sure he's doing everything he can. I have about 10,000 questions I want to bombard her with, but as we walk to the lifts, 2 are circling high above the rest. My father, I say as I press the lift button. Yes? Did he... Is it? You don't think... I can't say it out loud, but Mary understands exactly. Your father always maintained that Jocelyn Burton has a fertile imagination, and the affair was entirely fictitious, she says. Her full account is all there in the files for you to read. Thousands of words, very descriptive. However, you may feel that it's not helpful for you. Right, I say. Well, maybe... I watch the lift indicator changing 26, 25, 24, then draw breath. My father, I say again. Yes? I bite my lip. I don't know what I want to ask exactly. I've been reading the emails between Dan and my father. I try again. And, yes, Mary meets my eye, and I have a feeling that, again, she knows exactly what I'm driving at. Dan is very patient, very smart. I hope your father knew how much he did for him. But he didn't, though, did he? I say bluntly. I've seen it in those emails. Daddy was awful to him. I can't believe Dan stuck it out. Tears suddenly spring to my eyes as I think of Dan, uncomplainingly dealing with Daddy's charmless missives, never telling me a word. I mean, why would he? Why would he? Oh, Sylvie, Mary shakes her head with an odd little laugh. If you don't know... She breaks off, surveying me with such a wry gaze, I almost feel uncomfortable. You know, I've been intrigued to meet you all this time. To meet Dan Sylvie. Dan's Sylvie? A painful laugh rises through me. I don't feel like Dan Sylvie right now. If I were him, I would have left me ages ago. The doors open, and as I get in, Mary holds out her hand. Very nice to meet you at last, Sylvie, she says. Please, don't worry about this second book. I'm sure it'll all be resolved. And if there's any more information I can give you about Joss or Lynn... What? I stare at her, puzzled. What do you mean, Lynn? Oh, sorry, I know it's confusing. Mary raises her eyes ruefully. Jocelyn is her full name, but she was known as Lynn as a teenager. For legal purposes, obviously, we... Wait, my hand jams the hold button before I'm even aware I'm reacting. Lynn? Are you telling me she was called Lynn? Well, we generally refer to her as Joss, obviously. Mary seems puzzled by my reaction. But she was Lynn then. I thought you might remember her, in fact... In her account, she certainly mentions you. She used to play with you, sing songs with you. Kumbaya, that kind of thing. Mary's face changes. Sylvie, are you all right? I've been living inside a bubble, inside a bubble. I feel surreal. As I stride along Lower Sloane Street, the same phrase keeps running through my head. What's real? What's real? When I finally left the Avery Milton offices, I tried Dan's phone about 5 times. But he wasn't picking up, or didn't have signal, or something. So at last, I left a desperate, frantic voicemail. Dan, I've just found out. I can't believe it. I had no idea. I'm so sorry. I got it all wrong. Dan, we need to talk. Dan, please ring me. I'm so, so sorry. And kept on in that vein until the beep went. Now I'm heading to Mummy's flat. I'm in a bit of a state and should probably pause for a calming drink of something, but I'm not going to. I have to see her. I have to have this out. I've already phoned up the school and put the girls into after-school club. They're pretty good about last-minute phone calls from frazzled London working parents. I let myself into Mummy's flat with my latchkey, stalk into the drawing room with no greeting, and say in unforgiving tones, "You lied." Mummy jumps and looks round from where she was sitting, staring into space, a cushion clutched to her chest. She seems suddenly small and vulnerable against the vast expanse of the sofa, but I thrust that thought from my mind. "Lynn," I say, my eyes searing into hers. "Lynn, Mummy. Lynn." To her credit, she doesn't say, "What do you mean, Lynn?" She gazes past me as though she's looking at a ghost, her face slowly creasing up in anxiety. "Lynn!" I practically yell. "You told me she was imaginary. You screwed me up. She was real. She was real." "Oh, darling," Mummy's hand nervously crushes the fabric of her jacket. "Why would you do that?" My voice is perilously close to a wail, a childlike wail. "Why would you make me feel so terrible? You wouldn't let me talk about her. You made me feel so guilty. And all the time you knew she was real. It's sick. It's messed up." As I'm talking, an image flashes into my head of Tessa and Anna, my gorgeous girls with their precious thoughts and dreams and ideas. The idea of messing with them, altering them, making them feel bad about anything is just anathema. Mummy isn't answering. I stalk round to the front of the sofa so that I'm facing her, breathing hard. "Why? Why?" "You were so small," says Mummy at last. "Small? What's that got to do with it?" "We thought it would make things simpler." "Why simpler?" I stare at her. "What do you mean, simpler?" "Because we had to leave so hurriedly. Because why did we have to leave so hurriedly?" "Because that girl was making accusations." Mummy's voice is suddenly raw and harsh, and her face takes on the ugliest expression I've ever seen, a kind of contorted disgust which chills me to my heart. The next moment, it's disappeared. But I saw it. I can't unsee it. I can't unhear that voice. Our life was so glittery. I could never see anything but the gloss, the fun, the luxury. My handsome father and beautiful mother, my charmed, enviable family. But now, I'm seeing hectoring emails, lying parents, and ugliness lurking underneath everything. "Is there any..." I swallow hard. "Is there any truth in what she says?" "Of course not." Mummy's voice is harsh again, making me flinch. "Of course not. Of course not." "So why?" "We had to leave Los Bosques Antiguos." Mummy turns her head away, staring at the corner of the room. "It was all so unpleasant, unbearable." The girl told her parents her story, and obviously they believed her lurid tale. Well, you can imagine how they reacted, and they spread such vicious rumors among our friends. We couldn't have that kind of... We had to leave. "So you sold the house?" "I expect we would have sold anyway. And you told me Lynn was imaginary. You messed around with the mind of a 4-year-old. My voice is pitiless. "You kept asking about her, Sylvie." Mummy has developed a twitch in her left eye, and she smooths it away repeatedly. "Always asking, where's Lynn? Singing that wretched song?" "Kumbaya," I say quietly. "It drove your father mad. It drove both of us mad. How could we put everything behind us? It was your father's idea to tell you she was imaginary. And I thought, what would it matter? Real imaginary. You were never going to see her again. It was a harmless white lie. A harmless white lie." I feel incandescent with rage. I'm replaying a million moments from my childhood. I'm remembering Daddy's bristling, silent fury whenever Lynn came up. Mummy hastily glossing over the moment and changing the subject. But then, that's been her life, hasn't it? Glossing over the moment. There's silence in the room. I can't stay, but I can't bring myself to move either. For some reason, I'm fixating on Mummy's sofa. It's large and cream, with fringing and lots of bespoke cushions in pink velvet and damask and linen prints. It's beautiful. And she looks so blonde and pretty, sitting there in her pink suit. The whole picture is adorable, on the surface. And that's what Mummy has always been to me, I realize. Surface. All surface. Shine and reflection, bright smiles, designed to deflect. The pair of us have echoed the same lines to each other over the years, never pausing or examining them. Lovely skirt, delicious wine, Daddy was a hero. When did we last have a deep, empathetic conversation that actually went somewhere? Never. "What about Dan?" I say flatly. Dan, Mummy crinkles her brow, as though perhaps she's forgotten who Dan is, and I feel another flare of anger at her. Dan, who's been working his socks off for you. Dan, who's in Devon right now trying to protect Daddy's name, again. Dan, who is the hero in all this, but you treat him like, I flounder, like a joke. As I say the word, I realize it's exactly right. Mummy has never taken Dan seriously, never respected him. She's been polite and charming and everything else, but there's always been that slight curve to her mouth, that slight pitying air. Poor Dan. Darling, don't be ridiculous, says Mummy crisply. We all feel for poor Dan. I don't believe it. She's doing it again. Don't call him poor Dan, I snap. You're so patronizing. Sylvie, darling, calm down. I'll calm down when you treat my husband with respect. You're as bad as Daddy. I saw his emails to Dan, and they were rude. Rude. All this time, we've been behaving as though Daddy's the saint. Daddy's the star. Well, Dan's the star. He's the star, and he hasn't had any recognition, any thanks. Anger is spilling out, but it's anger at myself, too. I feel hot all over with self-reproach, mortification. I'm remembering the number of times I defended Daddy to Dan, the assumptions I made, the unforgivable things I said. You can't stand that Daddy was rich and successful. You're so bloody chippy, and I'm sick of it. I called Dan, who patiently put up with all that shit, chippy. I can't bear it. I can't bear myself. No wonder he got all tentery. No wonder he felt pinned in a corner. No wonder he couldn't stand us watching the wedding DVD, wallowing in the Daddy show. Shame keeps crawling over me. I thought I was so clever. I thought I was psychic Sylvie. I knew nothing. And even now, Mummy won't see it. She won't acknowledge any of it. I can tell it from her distant gaze. She's reordering events in her mind to suit herself like some algorithm, placing Daddy and herself in the center, and everyone else just floats to the sides. You sat here in this very room, I continue, and you said Dan's hardly the life and soul, is he? Well, he is the life and soul. My voice gives a sudden wobble. He's the genuine life and soul. Not flashing around, not showing off, but being there for his family. You've underestimated him. I've underestimated him. Tears prick my eyes. And I can't believe how Daddy just took him for granted, swore at him, treated him like Sylvie. Enough of this, snaps Mummy, cutting me off. You're overreacting. Dan is very lucky to have married into this family. Very lucky indeed. What? I stare at her, not sure I heard that right. What? Your father was a wonderful, generous, remarkable man. Think what he achieved. He would be distraught to hear you talking of him this way. Well, too bad, I explode. And what do you mean, Dan's lucky? He hasn't touched a penny of my family money. He's provided for me and the girls. He's put up with watching that bloody wedding DVD every time we come here, watching Daddy steal the show. Lucky? You and Daddy were lucky to gain such a fantastic son-in-law. Did you ever think of that? I break off, panting. I'm starting to lose control of myself. I don't know what I'm going to say next, but I don't care. Don't speak about your father like that, Mummy's voice rockets shrilly through the room. Do you know how much he loved you? Do you know how proud he was of you? If he'd loved me, he would have respected the man I love. He would have treated Dan like a proper family member, not like some underling. He wouldn't have lied about my imaginary friend because it was convenient for him. I stare at Mummy, my breath suddenly caught, my thoughts assembling themselves into a pattern which makes horrible sense. I'm not even sure he loved me as a person in my own right. He loved me as a reflection of him, as part of the Marcus Lowe show, the princess to his king. But I'm me. I'm Sylvie. As I speak, I glance into one of Mummy's gilt-framed mirrors and see my reflection. My waist-long blonde hair as girlish and wavy and princess-like as ever. It was Daddy. He loved my hair. Daddy, who stopped me cutting it. Do I even like long hair? Does long hair even suit me? For a few moments, I just stare at myself, barely breathing. Then, feeling heady and unreal, I walk to Mummy's writing desk and reach for the handmade scissors I bought her for Christmas one year. I grab my hair with one hand and start to cut. I've never felt so empowered in my life. In my life. Sylvie! Mummy inhales in horror. Sylvie! Sylvie! Her voice rises to a hysterical shriek. What are you doing? I pause, my hand mid-snip, a length of blonde hair already on the floor. I look at it dispassionately, then raise my head to meet her eyes. I'm growing up. Chapter 16. I get through the rest of the day on autopilot. I pick the girls up from after-school club and try to laugh off their dismayed exclamations.
Mummy, what's happened to your hair? Where's your hair gone? When will you put it back?
Anna, blinking anxiously at me.
Will you put it back now, Mummy? Now?
And my first instinct is somehow to protect them, soften the blow. I even find myself thinking, should I buy a long blonde wig? Until reality hits me. I can't protect the girls forever. And I shouldn't. Stuff will happen in their lives that they don't like. Shit happens. And they will have to cope. We all have to cope. We eat supper and I put them to bed, and then just sit on my bed. Our bed. Staring at the wall, until the events of the last few days overcome me, like a wave over my head, and I succumb to crying. Deep, heaving sobbing. My head buried in a pillow as though I'm grieving all over again. And I suppose I am grieving in a way. But for what? For my lost real/imaginary friend, Lynn? For the heroic father I thought I knew? For Dan? For our battered marriage? For the Sylvie I used to be, so blithe and innocent, tripping about the world with no bloody idea about anything? My thoughts keep veering toward Daddy and Lynn and that whole issue. Fabrication, whatever it was. But then I mentally jump away. I can't deal with thinking about it. The whole thing is just surreal. Surreal. And what I really care about, what I'm really fixating on like a crazy obsessed person, is Dan. As evening turns into night and I finally get into bed, I can't sleep. I'm staring up at the ceiling, words and phrases churning round my brain. I'm so sorry. I didn't understand. You should have told me. If I'd known. If I'd only known. He hasn't replied to my voicemail. He hasn't been in touch at all. I don't blame him. By morning I've dozed for a couple of hours, and my face is deathly pale. But I get up as soon as the alarm goes, feeling wired. As I'm getting dressed for work, I automatically reach for one of my Mrs. Kendrick-friendly sprigged dresses. Then I pause, my mind working hard. I push all my dresses aside and reach for a black suit with slim trousers and a well-cut jacket. I haven't worn it for years. It's very much not a Mrs. Kendrick sort of outfit, which is exactly what I want. My head has clarified overnight. I can see everything differently in the pale morning light. Not just Dan and me and our marriage and Daddy, but work. Who I am, what I've been doing. And it needs changing. No more ladylike steps, no more convention, no more caution. I need to stride. I need to grab life. I need to make up for lost time. I drop the girls at school and nod, smiling tightly, as everyone gasps over my new chopped hair. Parents, teachers, even Miss Blake, the headmistress as she passes by, all of them blench in shock, then rearrange their faces hastily as they greet me. The truth is, it does look quite brutal, Even I was shocked anew when I saw myself in the mirror this morning. I've never had cropped hair before in my life. I say pleasantly, yes, I fancied a change, and it needs a bit of tidying up, about 600 times, and then escape. I must book a proper haircut. I will do, but I have other things to do first. As I arrive at Willoughby House, Clarissa's jaw drops in horror.
Your hair, Sylvie, she exclaims. Your hair!
Yes, I nod. My hair. I cut it off.
Right. Gosh, she swallows. It looks lovely.
You don't have to lie, I smile, touched by her efforts. It doesn't look lovely, but it looks right. For me. Clarissa clearly has no idea what I mean, but then why should she?
Robert was wondering what you were up to yesterday, she says, eyeing me warily. In fact, we were all wondering.
I was cutting my hair off, I say, and head to the computer desk. The books are stacked neatly in a pile, and I grab them. They go back 12 years. That should be enough, surely.
What are you doing?
Clarissa is watching me curiously. It's time for somebody to take action, I say. It's time for one of us to do something. I swivel to face her. Not just safe little actions, but big actions. Risky actions. Things we should have done a long time ago.
Right, says Clarissa, looking taken aback. Yes, absolutely.
I'll be back later. I put the books carefully into a tote bag. Wish me luck.
Good luck,
echoes Clarissa obediently.
You look very businesslike, she adds suddenly, peering at me as though this is a new and alien idea. That trouser suit and the hair.
Yes, well, I give her a wry smile. It's about time. I arrive at the Wilson Cross Foundation with 20 minutes to spare. It's an office in a white stucco house in Mayfair and has a staff of about 20 people. I have no idea what they all do, apart from having coffee with idiots like me at Claridge's. But I don't care. It's not their staff I'm interested in. It's their money. The trustees' meeting begins at 11 o'clock, as I know from consulting the diary of events that Susie Jackson sent me at the beginning of the year. I've heard her describe trustees' meetings many times over coffee, and she's quite funny about them. The way the trustees won't get down to business but keep chatting about schools and holidays. The way they misread figures but then pretend they haven't. The way they'll make a decision about £1 million in a heartbeat, but then argue for half an hour about some tiny grant of £500 and whether it fulfills the brief of the foundation. The way they gang up on one another. The trustees of the Wilson Cross Foundation are very grand and important people. I've seen the list, and it's all service and dame that. But apparently, they can behave like little children. So, I know all this. I also know that today the trustees are making grants of up to £5 million, and that they'll be listening to recommendations, including from Susie Jackson herself. And what I know above all is that she owes us. I've told the girl at the front desk that I have an appointment, and as Susie comes into the reception area holding a thick white folder, she looks confused.
Sylvie! Hi! Your hair!
Her eyes widen in revulsion, and I mentally allot her a 2 out of 10 in the tactful response category. A 10 out of 10 goes to the girl's headmistress, Miss Blake, who caught sight of me and was clearly shocked but almost instantly said,
Mrs. Winter, what dramatic hair you have today, most inspiring.
Yes, my hair, whatever.
Did we have an appointment?
Susie's brow furrows as she consults her phone.
I don't think we did.
Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't replied to your email yet. Don't worry about the email. I cut her off. And no, we didn't have an appointment. I just want to borrow you quickly and ask how much of a grant you're planning to give Willoughby House today.
I'm sorry.
Susie looks perplexed. It was so great to see you at Claridge's for our meeting, and I do hope you enjoyed your cake, I say meaningfully, and a pink tinge comes over her face.
Oh, yes, she addresses the floor. Thank you.
I do believe in quid pro quo, don't you? I add sweetly.
Cashing in favours? Payback? Look, Sylvie, this isn't a good time, begins Susie, but I press on. And what I've realised is we've been waiting quite a long time for our payback. I reach into my bag and pull out the books. I marked them up with sticky notes before I came here, and I now flick to an old entry written in faded fountain pen. We first had a meeting with one of your predecessors 11 years ago. 11 years ago. She was called Marion, and she said that Willoughby House was exactly the sort of cause you should be supporting, but unfortunately the time wasn't quite right. She said that for 3 years. I flick to another of the books. Then Fiona took over from Marion. Look, on May 12th, 2011, Mrs. Kendrick treated her to lunch at the Savoy. I run a finger down the relevant handwritten entry. They had 3 courses and wine, and Fiona promised that the foundation would support us. But, of course, it never happened. And then you took over from Fiona, and I've had, what, 8 meetings with you? You've been treated to coffee, cakes, parties, and receptions. We apply every year for a grant, and not a penny. Right, says Susie, her manner becoming more formal. Well, as you know, we have many demands upon us, and we treat each application with great care. Don't give me the bloody spiel, I say impatiently. Why have you donated constantly to the V&A? The Wallace Collection, Handel House, the Museum van Loon in Amsterdam, and never Willoughby House? I've done my homework, and I can see I've hit home. But instantly, Susie rallies. Sylvie, she says a little pompously, if you think there's some kind of vendetta against Willoughby House... No, I don't think that, I cut her off. But I think we've been too polite and unassuming. We're as deserving as any other museum, and we're about to go bust. I can feel my inner Mrs. Kendrick wincing at that word, bust. But the time has come to be blunt. Blunt hair, blunt talk. Bust? Susie stares at me, looking genuinely shocked. How can you be going bust? I thought you were rolling in it. Didn't you have some huge private donation? Long gone. We're about to be sold off to be condos. Oh, my God, she seems aghast. Condos? We all thought. Well, so did we, I shrug. There's a long silence. Susie seems truly chastened. She looks at the folder in her hand, then up at me, her face troubled. There's nothing I can do today. All the budgets are worked out. The recommendations have been made. Everything's been planned out to the last penny. But it hasn't been agreed upon, I gesture at her white folder. These are just recommendations. You could unplan. Unrecommend? No, I couldn't. You could make an amendment. An extra proposal. It's too late, she's shaking her head. It's too late. The meeting hasn't begun yet. I suddenly flip out. How can it be too late? All you need to do is walk in there and say, hey, trustees, guess what? I've just heard some terrible news about Willoughby House going bust, and I think we somewhat overlooked them. So let's make a donation. Hands up, who agrees? I can see this idea lodging in Susie's brain, although she still looks resistant. That would be the right thing to do, I say for emphasis, and you know it. Here's a document with some useful information. I hand her a sheet with a few bullet points about Willoughby House written neatly on it. I'm going to leave this with you, Susie, and wait to hear from you, because I trust you. Have a good meeting. Somehow I force myself to turn and leave, even though there are hundreds more arguments I could make. Less is more, and if I stay, I'll only launch into some rant which will piss Susie off. Besides, I'm on a mission today. That was only part one. Now, onto parts 2, 3, and 4. By 5 o'clock, I'm exhausted, but I'm on a roll too. In all the time I've worked for Willoughby House, I've never put myself out like I have today. I've never pitched so much, or cajoled so much, or talked so passionately to so many people, And now I'm wondering, what have I been doing all this time?